this like Troy said, is kind of one part update, one part message, and it's fun to kind of how I see how God's able to kind of wrap those two things together when I get to be with all of you this morning. We've been in the States since June 16th. Visiting all of our supporters. We have been driving around lots of places. That rental car, in fact, had 3,200 miles on it by the time I turned it in. So that was quite something. The girls have experienced the East Coast road trip. We started in Atlanta, Georgia, and went down to Sarasota, Florida, and then drove all the way up to make it here to be with all of you. We just got in Friday evening. And as I like to say, too, we've saved the best for last. So this is why we're here to see all of you. We're headed out back to Czech August 16th. But this time it's been great just to reconnect with supporters and visit people, but now to be with our supporting churches here in Long Island in particular. The last time I was with you, I spoke a little bit on the Sermon on the Mount. It's my personal favorite passage that I like to spend time with in Scripture. And last time I kind of focused on the beginning side of it. And so this time I want to skip all the way to the end. So I feel like I can bookend stuff accordingly. And one of the things that's really neat about the Sermon on the Mount is this is the manual for life. This is what it is to be a Christian. This is Jesus' most complete teaching. And I really consider it an honor and a privilege to go there with all of you. So if we'll start off, we'll hit to Matthew 7, verses 24 through 27, the very end of the Sermon on the Mount. And it says this. Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise man who built his house on the rock. The rain came down, the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against the house, yet it did not fall because it had its foundation on the rock. But everyone who hears these words of mine and does not put them into practice is like a foolish man who built his house on sand. The rain came down, the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against the house, and it fell with a great crash. Now again, this is the wrap-up of the message. Jesus has been speaking to people on the side of an embankment. It started in chapter 5. He's now wrapping it up in chapter 7. This past year, actually, Audrey and I got to go to Israel and be in the very same place where they say he did the Sermon on the Mount. And the acoustics are unbelievably good. It's this embankment in the way in which Jesus could have either been at the top or at the bottom speaking, and everybody would have been able to hear it. And just, to, you know, when you hear people say you have to go to Israel to see the thing, they're right. Really, to get a sense of location was incredible. The only problem was we were there over Passover weekend, which was also for a lot of the Jewish people. It's holiday. It's like spring break. And so the Sermon on the Mount is right next to the Sea of Galilee. And so everybody had their party boats out, and they were having a grand old time. And the acoustics are too good because all of the party boats just wafted up into all of our contemplative time, if you will. So it wasn't what we were really expecting, but at least, you know, still you get to like, oh, okay, I get it now. It makes sense. But he's giving context. He's wrapping up this message, and he's saying, here's the big thing I want you to remember, the thing I want you to take away. That's always what the end of the message is about. And what I think is really interesting, too, at the end, you know, he's given this long list of what it is to be a follower of Jesus, what it is to be a Christian, if you will. And yet here he's still saying, like, look, if you put these into practice, if you have your foundation on the rock, you're going to have trouble. Things are going to come. You see that the wind and the rain, the streams rose, the winds blow in both verse 25 and verse 27. But the significance is, where have you put your foundation? What have you built upon? And everybody would understand this idea of what it is to build a house on a proper foundation. Again, being in Israel, we saw all different types of terrain in different places. Like I said, we have just driven 3,200 miles and stayed in I don't know how many houses. And it felt like every house we were in, though, somebody was talking about building or a building project. I mean, really, they were talking about property taxes, but everybody was talking about building in some way, shape, or form. And it's interesting because, you know, when we were down in Florida, they're talking about, you know, do they build on the water or build next to a canal. We have friends that are building a house between a stream and a river, and they've got to build the house elevated because they know that, you know, the water can rise up. When we were in South Carolina, we had people that were building inland, and they had to build on the side of kind of like a it was kind of like a hill to some extent, and it felt like it was elevated, but yet there's no basement. There's nothing underneath it just because of the way the land is. And then when we were in Virginia, they were building up in the mountains, and so they have more space and availability, but yet you have to think about the inclines and things. And yet no matter the size, no matter the shape, no matter the type of house, they all had one thing in common. A foundation. That's right. Every single one of them has a foundation. I remember hearing a story of a famous apologist who was going through Ohio State University, and they have a building there. I believe it's called the Wexner Center or something like this, and it's the first postmodern architectural structure. And what they mean by that is, like, there's stairs that go to nowhere. There's, like, a lack of a door in certain places. The whole point is to say, like, you don't need to follow rules. You can just build whatever you want to build, and it'll just function. And so the individual who was showing this to the apologist was just like, see, look, we can make architecture have no meaning whatsoever. And the apologist replied very cleverly, but does it have a foundation? Everything has a foundation. Everything has a foundation. And we are no different. We need a foundation as well that we are going to build our lives upon. This is what Jesus was talking about. And he has just given this example, this understanding of what it is, those key things that we want to build upon. And again, if we build them into our lives, like it says in verse 25, the rain came, the streams rose, the winds blew and beat against the house, but it did not fall because it had its foundation on the rock. That sounds great. There are storms in life. There are problems. We've seen that constantly. But there's also a bit of a problem, too, because do we just build our lives on the things that Jesus said? See, we like to have little additions, if we will, okay? So some of us, we want to build our homes, or, you know, we want to build our lives on the job that we have or the family we have access to, maybe our education, maybe our position that we hold within our job. Maybe it's a zip code as to where you live. Maybe it's your political leanings, all right? We see so many different people and so many tryings to build upon things that aren't going to last, that aren't going to hold. Society in particular is trying harder and harder to build upon good things because they keep taking good things away and trying to find some sort of substitution that will allow them to say, we can exist on this. We can exist on this. I was just recently at the European Leadership Forum in Poland, and this is a gathering of key figures throughout all of Europe, actually, not just Central Europe. And one of our evening speakers got up and said, Europe is in the midst of crisis because for the last 20 years, they said, we can be a post-truth society. And do you know what happens when you have a post-truth society? Yeah. Who knows? I mean, it's just kind of all up in the for whatever type thing. And they actually are coming to terms with you can't just have everything be nothing. Because when there is nothing, guess what? There's nothing, all right? There needs to be something. And they're having a hard time. And I would say that looking back over the last 10 years, being in Central Europe, we have seen a tectonic shift in culture. But more so within the last 4 years, I would say, as we've been back on the field in this new position. You see, the EU has supposed to have been and is touted to be the new land of opportunity, especially for young people. There is education. You know, you have opportunities the likes of which they've never had before. It was actually really funny. We were down in Florida, and one of our supporters said, "Okay, now, I know. Aside from the people, what do you really miss living over there? What do you like really need?" I stopped and I thought for a minute. I was like, Chick-fil-A? I mean, it's good pizza. Like, it's not, you know, the things that weren't are now the things that are. Like, guys, we have Amazon Germany, you know? Like, it's right, exactly. I mean, we still have two-day free shipping. I don't know if you have that anymore. I think you've ordered too many packages. You can't have it anymore. But the things, the stuff, the whatever that didn't exist before totally exists now. We see friends and family, people within our own church have means and opportunities, travel, vacation, holidays, things that didn't exist are now commonplace. The hilarious thing, we saw an article not too long ago even saying that Czechs are taking out short-term loans to pay for their vacations because inflation got so bad. But this idea of like, well, we're not going to not take vacation anymore. We've gotten used to these things. We have to keep it going. And I would say the same that we see within young people. Financial opportunities and technology has made the world a smaller place, and therefore more opportunities are at their fingertips. School in different countries, work in different countries, travel in different places. This post-communist generation has the world at their fingertips. And partially because, and I left my phone on my chair for just that reason, they've got those things in their back pockets, right? It literally is the world at their fingertips. And the crazy thing is now, like, our youth group kids have better iPhones than I do. When did that happen? That's not supposed to happen. Like, so the world in which we think that it was is not the world that it currently is. And again, within the midst of this, we have seen them moving from, young people in particular, I think we've seen them moving from this critical thinking, you know, deeply analytical, to more of a, I'm content. I'm complacent. I don't have to worry about the things that my parents had to worry about. I don't need to be concerned with the things that my parents or grandparents had to worry about. Their foundation is being built on a key thing. Stuff. They have lots and lots of stuff that they never had access to before. And what happens when you build your life around things and stuff? Huh? Crumbles. Right. It doesn't hold the way you think it would. What could possibly go wrong? Everything. Do you guys remember 2020? It's a great year. It's fantastic. It was just about a century, but who cares? It was 1 year or it was 12 years. We still don't know. But I mean, think about this. A once-in-a-lifetime pandemic hits when opportunity is at its peak. The rains came down, the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against the house, and it fell with a great crash. So the last time we were here, 2 years ago, we were still in the midst of it, as a matter of fact. And in fact, we probably had another 6 months still to go before we had reached the end of it, for lack of a better term. But in that time, and even since then, we've begun to see how much opportunity has been lost for this younger generation. And similar experiences here as well, too. Graduation, travel, opportunities, family things, all of them gone. Not to be replaced, not to be repeated. Really, these key life moments have been taken away. And then the ironic thing is, all of the stuff that was supposed to make them happy, all those little devices in their back pockets, guess what? It made it all worse. Because you're trapped inside your home and you're doom scrolling all day long through the social media or whatever else, the realization is that this thing that was supposed to bring contentment now actually brought discontentment and dissatisfaction at such a rate that it added to a mental health crisis that we're continuing to see the effects of. So this is the opening line of the report the Czech Ministry of Health submitted to the United Nations just recently. The crisis associated with the COVID-19 pandemic has affected the whole society, including young people. The COVID-19 crisis has had significant psychosocial impact on young people, causing disruption in their education and economic opportunities, social isolation, or health issues. In the first months of the pandemic, 20% of respondents stated that they had suffered from impaired mental health, at least moderate depression or anxiety. And this was a more than threefold increase on the figure prior to the pandemic at nearly 6%. And that was the first month. And this is also just in the Czech Republic. It says nothing of Estonia, Latvia, Montenegro, of Albania, Bulgaria, the different countries that we work with. All of these countries are impacted in ways in which we're still seeing the outward ripples of. And so we as an international team stand back and try and understand what has happened within this next generation and what continues to happen within this next generation. And the reality is, it was such a grim outlook on the horizon. Here we are with all of these mental health things, stuff that we didn't even really know how to encounter and deal with. What could possibly go, like, could it get any worse? And do you know when that report was published? Literally, February 18th, 2022, 6 days before Russia invades Ukraine. So the absolute impossible is taking place, a once-in-a-lifetime pandemic, and then we've just added another dose of the impossible, all right? War in Europe, 70-plus years on, and we are thrown into chaos, the likes of which we don't even know what to do. It's kind of a sad reality, but we say that COVID ended on Wednesday and the war started on Thursday. And for us on the international team, really, like, there was no buffer. There was no opportunity to kind of, like, take a breath and pause. We went right out of one crisis and right into another one, neither of which we were even remotely prepared for. I can't thank you enough for all of your prayers and reaching out when that hit, because the reality was, when it hit, we had no idea what to do. And I'm totally serious. I mean, when we talk about where your foundation is built, I would love to be able to say that I was the super strong, confident person who could stand on the sidelines and say, God's in control, everything's going to be fine. And I think it was more of like, yeah, God's in control, everything's going to be fine. You know, you have this idea of a belief of something, but then when it actually is pushed into a place where you have to be tested, it takes on a very different role. Audra and I went to bed February 24th, basically like, we need to pack a bag, we need to have an exit strategy, and we need to know how we're going to get out of here, because we're going to need to get out of here. Because in all reality, Russia was going to be the Russia we imagined them to be. They were going to roll right through, and would they stop? I don't know. What would be the fallout? What would be the different things that would take place? There were so many what-ifs in those first couple of days. You can't even put it into terms as to what we are supposed to do, because we've never been in a situation like this. Where is our foundation in those moments? Pandemic to invasion, to who knows what's coming next, what could we possibly do? The only thing we could really muster in those days, especially in those first ones, was to go to the Psalms, because nothing else really made a lot of sense. And so I went to Psalm 40, because it's my personal favorite, and it goes like this, Psalm 40. I waited patiently for the Lord, and he turned to me and he heard my cry. He lifted me out of the slimy pit, out of the mud and the mire. He set my feet on a rock, and he gave me a firm place to stand. He put a new song in my mouth, a hymn of praise to our God. And many will see and fear the Lord and put their trust in him. And blessed is the one who trusts in the Lord, who does not look to the proud or to those who turn aside to false gods. I waited patiently, David says. There's no panic move, no impulsive turns. He says, I waited. I had to stop, be still, And yet even in that cry out, God turns to me. He hears my cry. And yet he lifts me out of the pit and he sets my feet on what? A rock. A firm foundation. A place where we can stand. I think oftentimes, church, we find ourselves stuck, overwhelmed, maybe potentially even trapped. And we call out, we ask, where does he place us? He places us on something firm, something with which we can stand on. And many will see and fear. They'll put their trust in him. And again, almost in the same, mimicking the Sermon on the Mount, blessed, blessed, blessed in the beginning, blessed is the one who trusts in the Lord, who does not look to the proud, to those who turn aside to false gods. Now, what's another word for trust? What's another word we can assign to trust? Faith. That's good. Others? Belief. Yeah. It's always the dicey part in the sermon when, you know, I have a specific word that I want and I want someone else to say it. But it's good to just hear where other things come. Because, you know, you're not wrong also, too. Like, you know, you're not wrong. But I'm thinking of this word, hope. Ooh, right? Something hits differently with that. Hope. This is where you get the personal side of the message. Because for me, I feel like I've always been an optimistic person. And Audrey would tell you, to a fault. There is the eternal of just like, I don't think things are, you know, it's not really good. It's raining outside. Yeah, but now the plants will be watered. It's going to be great. You know, like she gets to a point we've had multiple times of just like, can you please stop being so positive? All right. Sometimes it's good for things to be sad. Okay, sure. And I will admit, I am an optimist. I enjoy that positivity and that outlook on things, but it's been a rough couple years. And so even for the optimists in us, I think we find ourselves sometimes standing back and going, what are we supposed to do? And yet this is where that word, hope, has come through in ways that I really couldn't even begin to kind of wrap my head around. Because the significance of it is now more than ever, hope is needed. A guiding light, something. That's why I said hope on the horizon. Because if you can't look to what is going to be, with all that has taken place, boy, you can get stuck in that mud and that mire. I need a rock. I need a foundation. I need something to put my focus into. And so hope is one of those things I've been leaning into really strong and what I wanted to share with all of you this morning. So let's go a little bit more into that one because it's one of the key trifectas, faith, hope, and love. Paul mentions this as a combo specifically in three different letters, as a matter of fact. In 1 Corinthians 13:13, you probably know this one. Now, these three things remain, faith, hope, and love, but the greatest of these is love. In Colossians 1:5-6, he said, faith and love that springs from the hope stored up for you in heaven and about what you have already heard in the true message of the gospel has come to you. Then 1 Thessalonians 1:3, he says, we remember before our God and Father your work produced by faith, your labor prompted by love, and your endurance inspired by hope in our Lord Jesus Christ. And then in chapter 5, verse 8, he says, but since we belong to that day, let us be sober, putting on faith and love as a breastplate and the hope of salvation as a helmet. Hope is so significant in a believer's life that the Lexham Dictionary says this about it. It says, the confidence that by integrating God's redemptive acts in the past with trusting human responses in the present, the faithful will experience the fullness of God's goodness both in the present and in the future. Okay, so let's put that in normal people terms. And what that says is this. It says, hope is taking the things that happened in the past, what God was able to do, combining it with what you are doing now, and constantly looking forward to the fulfillment of the promises that he gave and the kingdom that is coming. So it's this now and not yet idea. I don't know if you've heard that before, the now and the not yet. Here's a great illustration of it. We are going to be married for 17 years. Yes. Okay. Whew. All right, my sermon's done now. I'm over. That's all I needed to say. No, we're going to be married for 17 years this August. Actually, this coming Saturday, as a matter of fact. Yes. Congrats. See, I knew that. And yes, it's not written down in my notes. Exactly. I'm totally positive. But the day 17 years ago, August 5th, 2006, when I became, 2006. Oh, wait, no, 506. Right. I got it. The day that I said I do, I became what? A husband. Correct. Right? Now, would you say, honey, would you say that I was a husband fully and completely in that moment? Sure. But. Space for improvement. Of course. So here's this. All right. So when I say the now and the not yet, I want you to think about this. In that moment, the now, I became a husband. But I was not yet the husband that I hopefully am right now. Good? You know, you put yourself out there, gang. I'm just saying. And you gotta, you never know what's going to come back sometimes. You never know. So that's that same idea. You, as a follower of Jesus, the moment you decide to make that realization to follow after him, boom, in that now, you become a believer. But you're not yet in completion. This is what we're moving towards, all right? And this is that idea of the kingdom. This is hope in our lives that in that now, something changes. But yet there is still more to come. This is what Jesus means when he says, the kingdom is here. It is amongst you, but yet it has not fully come to pass. It's the life that he's talking about in the Sermon on the Mount, but it's also this picture of what will be, what is happening. Hope is what it is because hope says, I know the ending of the story. How many of you, it's like the first time you watched that Apollo 13 movie, okay? Hopefully you watched the Apollo 13 movie. If you haven't watched it by now, I'm going to spoil the movie for you. But also, what are you doing with your life that you haven't watched this movie yet, okay? I can't make up for your poor choices, so I'm sorry. Also, this is a historical event, but if you don't know space and NASA, whatever, again, that's on you. But think about it. If you, the first time you watched Apollo 13, how many people have watched Apollo 13, okay, yes? And how many people were aware of the events of Apollo 13 at the same time, too? Ish. You weren't sure? Oh, okay, all right. But, you know, you're watching this movie. But think about it. You know what happens at the end, right? But as you're watching the movie, what were you still like? What's going to happen? I mean, maybe they didn't survive. I mean, who knows? Maybe, like, you know, survived? Who survived? I'm not going to tell you. You have to watch the movie. So, but that's the crazy thing. You know what's going to happen, and yet you're still drawn into the midst of the story. This is that aspect of hope. You're still kind of terrified, like, hey, are they going to make it? You're still even kind of terrified in your own life, like, is God really real or his promises really genuine? Like, what's really going on with me? And yet, church, we know the end of the story. We know how it all is going to end. Let's take a look at another passage from Paul. Titus 2, 11 through 14. For the grace of God has appeared that offers salvation to all people. It teaches us to say no to ungodliness and worldly passions and to live self-controlled, upright, and godly lives in this present age while we wait for that blessed hope, the appearing of the glory of our great God and Savior, Jesus Christ. So salvation to all. This is that opportunity, that good news that we were talking about earlier, that gospel that young people in Central and Eastern Europe and young people in the United States and older people in Central and Eastern Europe and older people in the United States, everyone around the world, this is what we're talking about. And yet this other part in verse 12, it teaches us to say no to ungodliness and worldly passions, to live self-controlled, upright, and godly lives in this present age. What is that? Well, that's that foundation. That's that foundation that we want to build our lives upon because that teaching and understanding, that message, that Sermon on the Mount, that this is how you live, that's what we want to build upon. And in verse 13, while we wait. while we wait. Wait for what? The blessed hope, the return and the righting of all things, the appearing of the glory of our great God and Savior. This is the end of the story. This is the kingdom come. This is when the world is made new. This is when all will be what it is supposed to be. It is the happiest of endings. There's a song that I really enjoy at the moment. And this line is, it says, to exist in the face of suffering and death and somehow still keep singing. This is hope. This is the reality that we as believers get to impart on the world. So let's go back to Ukraine for a moment. Before the war, when we would hold events over there, our team, they are tireless workers, but they would try and hold a multi-church event. Troy was telling me that the youth group here also does stuff with the youth group at Dix Hills, which I think is super cool. That's great. But now, Troy, when you do that, do you, like, call up Stephen ahead of time and you say, if you take any of my people, so help me, dude. Right? We don't really operate like that. That's how the Ukrainian churches would operate, though. They wouldn't want to do a multi-church event because there was this territorial aspect. You're going to take our people. And maybe they're going to leave and all this sort of stuff. And so they wouldn't want to work together. They wanted to keep their distance. They were not engaged. And I also say they were also not really engaged with a lot of the society around them because they had more of that circle the wagons mentality than I want to be out there in the midst of stuff. And then war hits. Ay, ay, ay. And what do we see? The churches united. The aid stations that sent off the most of our supplies come out of churches. The place where people go and get help for the first part of the war were the churches. I mean, CNN even went into one of the churches that we work with directly and interviewed the pastor because they moved all the pews and set up a bunch of beds and then to get people in, to get people out. And most of you are aware that we would do evangelistic camps in the summertime throughout all of Central and Eastern Europe. This is one of our big things. Shell, you know very well. The most camps that are taking place this summer in all of JV are in Ukraine. Yeah. The most ministry that's taking place right now is in Ukraine. Because the need is massive. And instead of saying, oh, we can't do anything, there's war, we got to, you know, close up shop, blah, blah, blah. They said, no, they saw the opportunity. Because their hope is not in what is happening on the ground. But their hope is the end of the story of what is coming. Young people in Central and Eastern Europe are going through an incredible mental health crisis. But you know what that means? You know what the fallout of this is? That all the stuff that was supposed to bring them satisfaction and happiness doesn't. And so they begin to look other places. Now, there's good and bad to both of that. But the reality is we are seeing young people now in our neck of the woods that are asking questions they've never asked before. They're poking into places they've never poked in before because the emptiness in their soul cannot be filled by an iPhone. They are looking for something else, and they are finding it in Jesus. This is what we get excited about. So, church, remember, you know the ending. You know how this is going to end. And if we've heard it one time, we've heard it plenty of times, that people bemoan the fact of what's going on in the United States. And I will agree, it's very different from when we left. But you know the end of the story. You know how it is going to turn out. Be encouraged and encourage others along the way. I'll leave you with this last thing. Tim Keller died this year, as many of you know. And I would say that to me personally, it hit really hard. I do not know the man. I've only seen him speak once in person. But I have admired him for as long as I can remember. To me, he's been a North Star in the midst of plenty of other ministry things gone wrong. And when he was diagnosed with cancer a few years back, he sat for an interview with Russell Moore from Christianity Today, and he essentially said this. He said, if Jesus Christ rose from the dead, honestly, if he got up, he walked out of that tomb, he talked to people, he engaged with the world around him, then everything is going to be okay. Everything is going to be okay. We know the ending. We know that even in the darkest of circumstances, in the midst of pandemic, in the midst of war, in the midst of mental health crisis, there is hope on the horizon. We know the end of the story, and everything is going to be okay. Let's pray. God, I thank you that this is not about us, that this is not about what we do or our abilities, our skills, or anything along that line. I thank you that the story is written and we know the ending. I thank you for the reality of hope in Jesus Christ. And so as we continue here to wait, we wait for you expectedly, and we wait for you to move in each of our lives. God, I pray this church would be encouraged as they have encouraged us so many times before. Thank you for the ability to be home. Thank you for the ability to share the hope, the good news of Jesus Christ. Amen.